So, we have a very exciting bonus episode for you today. Kaylee and I were lucky enough to virtually sit down with Colm Feore. You'll know him from countless movies and TV shows. The Chronicles of Riddick, Amazing Spider-Man 2, Bon Cop Bad Cop, The Umbrella Academy, dozens of seasons at the Stratford Shakespeare Festival, and of course, King Laufey in Thor. He was so kind and generous with his time. We had so much fun talking with him, so please enjoy Colm Feore.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I wanted to ask you, first of all, being a newbie myself, what was your experience with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the comic books, or any of the superheroes, either in Thor or the other films or comic books prior to your involvement in the early 2010s?
It was very limited, except, you know, when I was a kid, there were the comic books, and we had those. There were also, as I recall, there was a cartoon. There was a Thor cartoon, there was Spider-Man, there was Batman. And, you know, I was pretty keen on all those because I'm old enough to remember when TV was new. And, you know, the Saturday morning run of cartoons was really something we looked forward to. And Thor had a pretty cool hammer. He was this really handsome Scandinavian dude. And, you know, one admired all these guys. And Captain America was there. And I lived in Windsor. So we would get stuff, you know, just across the airwaves from Detroit. So if it wasn't just CBC, limited to what CBC could buy, we were getting American channels, ABC, CBS, NBC. So, you know, the palette was a little bit wider. And that was it, you know. And then, of course, I went away and became an actor, and particularly a classical actor. And I think that had some impact on the, you know, the whole view of heroic mythology. You know, it takes a certain kind of sensibility to want to be a classical actor. And, you know, that's what I started doing. And that's what I began as, and I trained as, because no matter how you look at it, most of our training at the National Theatre School, which I went to here in Montreal, gears you up to be ready to do whatever is required from great classical plays, be it Shakespeare or, you know, any of the greats in that genre, and then Molière, Chekhov, etc. But classic, right? So they have a grandeur to them, even if they're Chekhovian and domestic. They still are elevated. I mean, that is the first day you know it's up here. And so that jives very well with a superhero universe. And I've always felt that, you know, the reason you see so many classical actors in the superhero universe is because we're trained to not find this stuff unusual. People just talk like this. They just do. It's noble, it's heroic, it's grand and mythological, sometimes poetic. And we're sort of cool with that. And we've trained for it. And we've trained for hammer use, swords, broadswords, battle axe, dancing, some, you know, pavans, and a little bit of singing. You know, the leap is not that far.
We certainly noticed that. I mean, we're watching them in release order. So we started, of course, with Iron Man and then Iron Man 2, which live a little bit more grounded in reality. Of course, there's this super suit that he flies in. But we came to Thor, and it was a huge leap from what we had previously seen, both in the colorization of the film, the, you know, otherworldly, other dimension aspect to it, and then all these Shakespearean-trained actors. And Brits, Canadians, you know, it felt like this grander scope. And I remember saying in our episode about Thor, I said, they're playing it like it is King Lear. The stakes are so high, and it is this classical text, but it lives in everyone's mouths and bodies as if you're speaking, you know, a modern day drama.
What was that like being on set with people who weren't just incredible actors, but particularly honed for this kind of storytelling?
Well, I'm going to rewind because Kaylee's hit on something very intuitive and very correct. The reason the first Thor is as excellent as it is all down to one guy, Sir Kenneth Branagh, now happily knighted. So Sir Kenny was asked to direct this show. And when he asked me to do it, he said, I know what you're thinking. Why, what on earth am I doing directing this show? And he said, I'm pretty sure that what happened at the Marvel exec level is somebody said, this is a, it's a classic piece. I mean, who do we get for this? It's classic. It's a classic. It's a classical piece. It really is. You're right. So we should get a classical guy, a classical actor. Classic. Who? There's only one. And so it's a Ken gets the job, right? And then he said about, he said, okay, so I accepted the challenge. But then he set about and spent something like 2 years convincing them to rewrite the script and to reorganize the script so that, in fact, it resembled King Lear.
Yeah. Mm.
And then he insisted that they hire Tony Hopkins, et cetera, right? And he really did stick to building this universe, this world, this community, based on his very grounded, fundamental Shakespearean sensibility. And he wanted the lines to resonate. He wanted the storyline to resonate absolutely as if you were watching King Lear. And in fact, Tony and I were together with him, and I'd worked with Tony before on Julie Taymor's Titus. I played his little brother. Mm. We were in Rome for about 6 months, getting to know each other. And so I had immense respect for his ease and facility with this kind of thing. And when Kenny was directing us, he'd say, okay, Tony, this is Lear. This is the disappointment you face. These children are just wretched, blah, blah, blah. And to me, Tony says, it's Winter's Tale, Act Two, Scene. You remember that bit where he does this? And so there's a kind of classical actor shorthand that we could use. And, you know, I'm familiar with this. I did Chronicles of Riddick ages ago for Vin Diesel and David Tui. And who's in there? Judi Dench. Mm-hmm. Linus Roach. The place was lousy with classically trained actors. You know, it seems kind of odd until you understand that everything about the experience is heightened. Mm-hmm. The clothes, the words. So everything has to be filled and inhabited on that slightly elevated level, and still no less true, no less real, no less honest. And if you look at the casting that Ken did, you know, you've got Natalie Portman, a brilliant actress, Stellan Skarsgård. You've got all these wonderful people. You think, oh yeah, good, good, good. They could all have their own movies by themselves, right? Rene Russo, just delightful. The first reading was just heaven. And one of the things among the many, many, many things Kenneth Branagh is good at is marshaling large groups of people as a military operation. Hmm. And he is uncannily in command of all the worlds, and he knows everyone's name. You walk into a studio full of 250 people, and Ken will turn to the prop master, he'll turn to the sound guy, a couple of security guys, the drivers, Charlie, how's the wife and children? Good, very nice to hear. Ladies and gentlemen, could we please all focus now? Our attention is on the artists, if you don't mind.
Fantastic.
It's extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. And so that is just the beginning of why that is as good as it is. And then he spent every day on the set and every day in editing, making it better and better and better. And just to return to why it looks like that, one of Kenny's favorite cinematographers is Haris Zambarloukos. And we shot on film in wide, you know, huge anamorphic wide. And with that, there's an intangible richness that you can get with the quality of the negative that then they augment with their digital magic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's a huge, big, hairy deal.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we watched a feature last night that was on the Frost Giants particularly. So we saw you getting all, you know, geared up into your incredible prosthetics and makeup. And then some of the rehearsals, it looked like, were in this feature. And Sir Kenny, if I can call him that.
Kenneth, yes.
He was there. He looked like he cared about every single department equally. And then he was right up there with the actors and the green screen behind. It looked like it was such an involved, almost theatrical rehearsal sort of process.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, it was. He leaves no stone unturned. And one of the things he clearly understands so well is that every single frame, every single moment, every single beat is going to be perused with the kind of detailed, exact precision and curiosity that you guys are looking at it with, right? So in order for that to be rewarding, he's got to put that much attention into it. I mean, it took years off his life, I'm sure, and years of his life simply to do. And he's, because he's so good and so experienced in all his Shakespeare film experience and all his Shakespeare acting experience and directing experience, he knows how to draw a performance out of an actor. He knows how to not give up on an actor. Mm. And he knows where he wants to be, right? So he already has this, which is the essence of good photography. He's pre-visualized where he wants to be. And he knows what the foundation is. He just needs to get us all there at the same time, on the same page. And so it's an immensely difficult and fully engaged job. And he does it standing right beside the camera. And he will not let up. But because of the planning, because of the structure, because, as I say, the military nature of the operation, he pretty much always got what he needed.
It's incredible. It really stands out as an ensemble piece, where Iron Man 1 and 2 really felt Robert Downey Jr. led, wonderfully so. Thor has always felt to me like it was a really cohesive, everyone on the same page kind of thing. And even though we're thrust into this wild new world of fantasy and gods and all kinds of crazy names being thrown at us, it's very understandable because everybody feels very on board within the production. And so it's incredible to hear that he was what created that.
He also takes care to introduce the characters sufficiently so that you go, oh, okay, I must remember you. Yes, get it, got it, check. Mm. You know, you see Idris Elba show up, you know exactly who he's going to be. You know who people are. And so that attention to detail, first of all, gives us an enormous amount of confidence, but also lets us know that he's taking care. He was very gracious with me. He said, look, I know it's 5.5 hours to get into the makeup. It's 2 hours plus to take it off. He said, I'll never do this to you unless I'm really going to use you.
Right. And
you'll never sit around. So, you know, I'd show up at 3 a.m. so everybody else could show up at 9. And then,
Yeah. Going.
And then I'd still, you know, I'd be at the grocery store. I had an apartment or a hotel right next to the studio because there was no point in going great distances.
Sure.
And I'd still be in the grocery checkout with blue eyeliner going, no, I'm sorry, just the last, but I couldn't get off. If you've seen the makeup, and I had at least 4 Oscar winners working on this.
Oh, yeah.
And it's based on a half-naked Iggy Pop. That was the, they did body casts of me. And then I get to do the preamble stuff and I get to the FX studio and there's a big, you know, life-size version of me next to a huge photograph of Iggy Pop. I've sculpted like Iggy Pop. Went, you know, that's okay. Saves me going to the gym. This is awesome. But if you see the genius of the layers, and this was the first makeup, this kid, Aryan, who did this makeup. I think it was his first makeup job, but he's a special effects creator. So he crafted the design of the creature and everything was analog. The eyes, the teeth, everything. They made me look slightly bigger. Obviously, I'm the Napoleon of Frost Giants. I admit. But, you know, the camera angles and a little bit of, you know, vocal adjusting of timbre and pitch and things like that made me seem bigger. And I was next to guys who were, you know, cast at 9.5 feet tall and then put in these huge suits.
Yeah.
They're not quite as fancy or as expensive, so they used to overheat a lot and fall down.
Oh.
He took care of them. It was a massive undertaking. And Ken was, as I say, very careful to say, don't worry, when we use you, we'll use you up and we'll get through this material as quickly as possible.
I wonder what they did with those casts of you that they made. Do you think they're somewhere in a warehouse or did you get them?
No. My makeup was carefully removed. Well, once it was on, if I had to go to another studio, I would be put in a black bag, ushered to a golf cart, surrounded in black bags, be driven across the street. I said, guys, what the heck are you worried about? And they said, helicopters. I said, what? Helicopters and people taking pictures of the makeup. I said, who cares? Nobody. Nope. That's what we're doing. Then as we took the makeup off, it was shredded.
Wow.
So no piece of it could be found in a dumpster, or this is Laufey, this is the King of the Frost Giants, this is Jotunheim, this is how it's going to look. Nothing. Shredded, melted down, never to be seen again.
Wow.
Unreal.
The secrecy.
Very, very careful.
Well, yeah. And that leads into something else I wanted to ask. So we're now 20 films into this whole saga, and we know how big and expansive and elaborate the Marvel Universe gets, now owned by Disney too, so you know they can do anything they want. But back then, when this was only the third film, what was the feeling like? Did they already have an idea, the Marvel higher-ups, was there already this feeling of this is going to be larger than just this one summer blockbuster? This is going to be something expansive and epic?
I think absolutely yes. I mean, Kevin Feige, the head of Marvel, was very seriously committed to the idea. I think they didn't begin the first one without a long-range plan for many, many more, and those universes intersecting and all the other fun stuff that's happened. It doesn't make any sense, pardon me, economically, to not think like that, because ours was a huge commitment. Those sets were real. We built my ice planet. Mm-hmm. It was a great, you could work on it, right? We would run on it. It had mountains and various levels that we could play. It was an extraordinary investment. And you simply don't do that unless you're looking at long-term recoupment and a kind of way to not only get your money back, but develop your storyline. So right. that you know you have layers and layers of spin-off material, and every character has potential. I was told at the end of it that I wasn't really dead. I was sort of dead, but there's a planet that the sort of dead go to be resurrected if need be. I thought, oh God.
That's what we've learned from watching these films, is you might think someone is dead, but they're never.
I was thinking of Billy Crystal. Turns out your friend is only mostly dead.
Yes.
Mostly dead is a little alive. And, you know, I had visions in the Chronicles of Riddick where my people are the dead. We are the necromongers. Right. So we're like already dead. So killing us puts us to a new dead level. But clearly there's a place for that. And I had visions, because we'd signed multiple contracts in case they came back, there would just be me and Judy Dench now on Vin's side going, Vin, in flowing white robes, of course, this way. And that would be our commitment for part two. Part three would be, sorry, this way, you know, as we got together. But as yet, they haven't called back for Laufey from the grave. But, you know, they have to have that kind of long-range commitment. And these guys are pretty fanatical. And I mean that in the best fanboy sense, that everybody and the Marvel executives, you know, they would be on the set all the time, helping, advising. I remember one of them being very kind and gracious and showing me personally and physically how he thought my ice punches and icicle driving might go.
Yeah.
This is seriously invested in this. You've given some thought to my ice weapons. And okay, you know, I had two, and Ken and I had discussed how this might happen. But the fact that we were getting all kinds of input from the executive, you know, just showed you how keen and how committed they were, because it was a long-term franchise. And yes, of course, it's Disney as well. And that expands their universe, if you'll forgive the phrase.
Yeah, I mean, like yourself, these are people who grew up with these characters and they've had their whole lives to think about them. And now they get to create these films and tell these stories in a way that they want to. So it really does seem like from the top down, it's everybody involved for the love of it.
And with enormous amounts of other people's money. And yeah, I can't tell, well, you know, listen, it makes a huge difference. Obviously, it's got to succeed on a massive global scale to make that worthwhile. But when you put those kinds of people like Harris and Ken and Tony Hopkins and that in a room with the likes of Hemsworth and Hiddleston and Portman, you know, it's big doings, right? You've got some serious commitment. You need to have something beautiful to look at. It's got to make sense. It's got to knock you out. It's got to be overwhelming. You want the biggest, if you're at home locked down, you want the biggest damn screen Zares can sell you. Yes. You know? You really do. And you want a big sound system. You want to be immersed in it. And they get that. So you know, they spare no expense. Mm-hmm. And I think that is part of the joy of it and part of the professionalism of it. So that every one of us, certainly when I was there, were profoundly engaged in our responsibility to get this right. Mm-hmm. At this level, to do it with the greatest preparation and polish that we possibly could.
Yeah.
That is so evident. The stakes are so beautiful. And one thing we talk about in our podcast a lot, or we end up talking about a lot, is what makes a compelling villain? Because there's a genre or a trope of kind of the Scooby-Doo villains of who's the villain this week and then defeating the villain. That can sometimes happen. But then there's the villains that have, you know, really compelling motives and not just sympathetic motives or intentions, but you can really see where they've either been scorned before or what leads to them having such a vendetta against whoever our protagonist is. And so it's so fantastic we get to speak with you, who portrays such a compelling, interesting, scorned villain who's obviously had a long time to sit presumably alone on the Frost planet, having been scorned by Odin all those centuries past. And I wonder how you approach playing a character like that and how, you know, seeing Laufey's design for the first time and all of that kind of informed your creation of Laufey.
Well, as I said from the outset, the script that Kenneth spent so much time refining was a very good indication of what he was going to want. And as the designs came through for the giant himself, I thought that they had very kindly, you know, taken note of my inadequacies and tried to erase them, you know, or fill in the blanks and make some really potent shape of them. He is kind of carved out of ice. Mm-hmm. He takes advantage of some of the, you know, the reasons that I get villains a lot. You look at the bones in my face and the way it catches the light. It's a trick of light merely, and an Irish potato eating heritage, but whatever it's from, it's damned handy when you're playing the bad guy. And if you can infuse them with some kind of soul or damage and history, all the better. Because even in repose, and that's, I think, one of the things that was particularly wonderful working with Harris, I knew that once this guy in that carved, sculpted shape was placed on his throne, isolated, up high, chipped out of ice, in chipped ice, cold, blue, dripping, miserable, that, you know, it's kind of NAR. Right? No acting required. Mm. Don't screw up the shot. So as the camera pan, and Ken had this, you know, worked out to an nth degree that, the, you know, the reveal of Laufey is going to be very specific and hopefully very impressive as we discover him here in this place. Red eyes sees him. What the hell are we going to do with this guy? Huh. Who is he? So that there are more, it begs more questions. Mm. And as an actor, and particularly in the cinema, I've always appreciated that and being a collaborator in that, so that, you know, I'm a method actor and my method is to go where the light is most beautiful, because I'm pretty sure that between me and the cinematographer, we're going to tell half the story without saying a word, because, you know, you do most of the work as a viewer. If the theater is about sending out, I think movies are about allowing in. And so as you pan across and reveal this guy in this place at this moment, you want to know. And I think less is more. So the more I have on board of his damage and his rancor and his unhappiness and how long it's been and how badly he wants to get rid of Odin and how he wants to be right over him and drive a knife through his fucking skull, you know? Yeah. And we see all that later on. And retrospectively, or on second, third, or 45th viewing, we go, oh yeah, I could see that that was the kind of guy who would end up doing this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right? And I could have wished that there was more of him, but, you know, you do what you're asked to do. Mm. Those are the layers, right? And you know, I'm not going to be coy with you. Part of the reason I got the job is I came with a grab bag of classical experience, right? Ken only had to say to me, Iago, Scottish king, you know what I'm saying? Leontes, mad, crazy, jealous, angry, just, and we could cue into an enormous amount of rehearsal we none of us could afford to have on the day with 250 people waiting to shoot a scene.
Right.
Right, of course. Right?
So, I mean, it's a huge advantage. I feel enormously grateful. My background has been a very, very rich foundation from which to draw for this kind of thing. It also means that I can add layers that aren't really there. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, I can add, I'm kind of a recycler as well. So if there's stuff I didn't use as Macbeth or as Leontes or as Iago, I go, I'll put it in here. What the heck?
Yeah.
I'll throw a little in. And because Ken was absolutely of that mind, you know, I want Lear here. Mm-hmm. I want this to be a titanic battle between these guys. Mm-hmm. I will frame it. I will build it cinematically in such a way that the audience feels this. But you've got to still bring the performance. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's such an intoxicating stillness that I saw.
I was going to say the same thing too, yeah.
In Laufey that is just flickers in the eye or, you know, long held eye contact with the occasional blink. That is, it's just well, so that,
but you're so, I'm so grateful that you pick out these things because that was the hardest part of my job, was to get my eyeballs to get the fake scleral contact lenses, hand-painted red scleral lenses, which were sucked into place and sucked out of place by a brilliant on-set technician with eye drops and whatnot. And she would graciously stand by and take them out if we weren't going to work for a bit, slop them back in, and then try to get them to line up with what I was thinking, because otherwise it looked like I wasn't at all well, you know. Yeah, the one eye looking at you, one eye looking for you. You go, it's not quite the performance I wanted to give.
Yeah,
a cross-eyed cat. But that was really part of the job of mastering the makeup and trying to get it to do what you wanted it to do. You know, another hard day at the office.
I was amazed to see that was also analog because I just thought red eyes, this must be added in post, but
oh no, these
you were working
are
through
absolutely
that.
Absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
And there's an optometrist, a shop in LA where that's what they do.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hand painted scleral. Scleral, I believe, means the whole eyeball.
Yeah.
So your eyeball gets fitted. You go to fittings for these things. And then they get a set of these and you have to very carefully put them in and take them out and away they go. I'm not sure if they shredded those and you could make new ones after, but they were always.
You brought them home just for fun?
I got nothing.
Aww.
We'll see those at some Disney auction down the line.
Well, Disney's very careful. They keep all of their stuff for, you know, just good business economics. You might need it again. Let's keep a warehouse full of the stuff. We're not used to be, you know, back in the day that you would negotiate to get the suit you wore in a movie. Now, certainly for Disney, they stopped that years ago.
Yeah.
Just to, you know, keep a close eye on everything that is theirs.
Yes.
Well, and it's fascinating to hear that, you know, they even bagged you up as tightly as they did for the helicopters. Just the secrecy involved is so intense.
Well, you know, keep in mind, this was pretty new, and they knew that the fan base, I mean, they need a bigger audience than just the wild fans, but what I was surprised at, and they took great pains to protect and prepare for, was the zeal with which fans would go after information. You know, scripts were shredded. I never wanted to have a side near me once we'd used them. I don't want them. I just delete. I want nothing to do with this. Because and everything is watermarked with your name on it. So if it appears on the internet, you're so fired. You post a selfie from the set, you're fired. And that was, it was a very rigorous protocol for the kind of safety for the story and for all the decor and design. Because, look, they have multiple levels of business monetizing this stuff, right? They'll have action figures. They'll have this. If you get imagine a worst case scenario, somebody gets a quick shot at Chris Hemsworth in his best outfit. You get a shot of that. Before you know it, it's being knocked off in a factory somewhere and sold before they release the movie. Because this stuff takes years to do. Yeah. So I get that they are, you know, absolutely crazy about their security and safety in this. And I'm all for it. One of my favorite examples of the set security and respect for it was doing 24. Because 24, obviously, you didn't want to know the ending. But 24 was started by a bunch of, you know, it worked on by a bunch of Canadian people.
Yes.
So when it got to LA, I did season 7, and there wasn't a huge protocol thing on that. There was a note on the script. So, hey, listen, this is just for your eyes only, because, you know, if you let anybody else know, it really sort of wreck it.
Right. Yeah.
Because it was like, oh, some Canadians. They went, yeah, right. Fair enough. No problem. And we did. We simply respected it because, you know, you're part of the team and you don't want to be the person that ruins it for everyone. Mm-hmm. There's just too much love, attention, and you know, money spent on making it good. So it was really serious, and it's still serious. I work on these things. I'm doing the Umbrella Academy for Netflix and Universal now, and mm-hmm. we've been crazy about our privacy ever since we started.
Yeah,
because it would just destroy it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't tell you anything if you get a little trickle of information, because half the stuff out there is misleading, and it spoils the fun. And so I'm all for this. I want not to know until they want me to know.
Well, that's like exactly it. I don't want the sneaky photos of an unfinished costume from set. I'd rather wait until I see the final product that the artists completed.
I want to be with the author's intention. Absolutely. Yeah. I want to see the final frame at the premiere or on the release, the first streaming day. That's because that's all our art. That respects everybody's position. And it's such a collaborative art, all of this stuff. Everybody's had a hand in one frame of film. And so, you know, out of respect for everybody's involvement, you kind of just do what you have to do.
Yeah.
Well, speaking about that and seeing it on the premiere, what was that like to see what you've been working on with green screens and all sorts of tricks of camera, to see it fully fleshed out with the voice modifications that they did and all of that?
Well, it was pretty awesome. I mean, it was pretty extraordinary because, of course, it's a huge, big show. So it got a huge, big red carpet treatment. They graciously invited us to the party. My wife, Dawn, and I went down, and it was fun. It was great fun to see everybody there, but also to see the thing in a movie theater. I mean, God, don't we miss that now?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
You see it in a movie theater and they give you popcorn, and at the end of it, they shepherd you over to somewhere else and they buy you a drink and say, well done. We think this is going to do okay. And you know, you're also looking at the launch of careers. For old actors like me, it makes not a whit of difference. When you see Chris and Tom Hiddleston and all these guys that you think are just delightful folks, going on then to lunatic success, mm-hmm. you know, going, as Ken said, galactic, and they have, and still maintained, you know, their decency and kindness and good fellowship. It's enormously encouraging and heartening. Mm.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was an awful lot of fun.
I bet there were folks that you were seeing there that you hadn't seen since the first table read, since they were appearing in Scenes on Earth.
Absolutely. And some of them, you know, they were in disguise because I'd seen them made up. I remember being in a hotel. This is going to sound very grand, mm-hmm. but I was in a hotel in Munich with my family. We were on a quick dash to Munich, having bugged out from Budapest, where we were shooting something else, and the family had come to visit me. And because flights then out of there were crazy cheap, we'd do Venice, Munich, Vienna. And there we were in this very nice hotel. And one of the actors from The Gang, it was Ray Stevenson. What does he play? The big, hairy, monstrous fella that's a pal of Thor's.
Oh, from Asgard.
Yeah.
What's his name?
And
with the red beard.
And so we're sitting having our dinner in the dining room of this very fancy hotel, the Bayerische Hofer, I think it was. And he walks in with a gang of people, and I recognize somebody famous. I think, oh my gosh, they're here shooting a movie. And I looked at him and I went, wait a minute, I was in a film with him and he spoke. And it was only because he spoke. And I had to go over and say, excuse me, Ray, is that you? Hi, Colin Firth. We were in 4 together. Sorry, we may have met at the premiere, but you know, good job. Well done. Magnificent. What are you doing here? So,
I was in The Blue. Do you remember The Blue?
And listen, that happens a lot. There were guys who were doing the editing and who had edited me before. I had no idea it was me until I came in to do the ADR. And then one said, I knew it was you. I knew it was you because of this, because that wasn't, you know, enhanced. It was just covered with the same shape. And he said it in the voice, even though we'd manipulated it. And obviously we'd done other films together. So, you know, that kind of stuff is such fun. And it does make this not seem like a job, but like simply the best way to make a living in the world.
Yes. Well, covered pretty much everything, I guess.
We'd be remiss if we didn't bring up the fact that several times in the podcast, Kaylee has brought up her love of Pearl Harbor.
Oh, gosh.
So you have not only been mentioned via Thor, but also your influence in Pearl Harbor.
Well, and even before we saw Thor, because I'm not doing any research on any of these films. I'm watching them completely blind. And then I'll watch the credits roll and go, Kenneth Branagh directed this? You know, and find out things afterwards. But without even knowing that you had such an integral part of Thor, I had mentioned Pearl Harbor as I made a comparison in one of the earlier Iron Man films. And then we saw Thor, and there you were. And so we talked about Pearl Harbor again, because I swear that was a seminal film of my youth that I went to see probably 9 times in the theater. So this is only just a compliment to just say you've made the podcast in many different ways.
Well, I'm happy to hear. Yes, Pearl Harbor was like my second or third Ben Affleck picture.
Wow.
Trifecta of those. Yeah. And Pearl Harbor's, you know, again, one of those things that's going to tell a heightened story, right? So if you look around, there was a bunch of, Peter Firth was in there doing wonderful stuff. A couple of us standing around in beautiful Navy uniforms in the yard down in Pearl Harbor, waiting to shoot. And I was saying, what are you doing here? He said, I'm here for the disemboweling. Are you really? Oh, what are you? Well, I'm going to be the one who mistakes the Japanese for another aircraft and lets them bomb it. Oh, I see. Okay.
Right.
And, you know, I had said, I'll confess, I'd said no to Pearl Harbor initially, but for scheduling, various reasons. And Bonnie Timmerman, for whom I'd done The Insider for Michael Mann, phoned me at home, and she's a casting director of great note, and I didn't think she had my number. And she said, I'm not sure you understand. You will be doing this film. And I said, why? You don't need me. And then she explained, and I realized why she was right. Guys like me get cast in films like that so that when Ben Affleck turns and kisses the girl, everybody at home knows sort of where they are and what's happening. Mm-hmm. I'm a context guy. I explain, so the Japanese are going to bomb, are they? And so what's the damage? I see. And what can we expect to happen? Where are we exactly? And we really did reshoots on Pearl Harbor because people were unclear as to exactly where it was. And so I stood beside an extruded map of Hawaii, pointing sagely, but rather curiously, at the harbor and going, so that's it, right? I was the commander of the fleet in the Pacific. What an idiot. I don't know. But, you know, we had to clear it up for some of our audience who were perhaps less geographically capable.
Yes, with the location in the title of the film.
Yeah. Well, I'm very grateful that you're paying attention. There's lots more
boy.
To watch, Kel, you know.
Yes. Well, I was on tour a couple years ago, and I pulled up into my new hotel room somewhere in Florida, turned on the TV. It was always my Monday night after travel day ritual. Turn on the TV, and there you walked onto screen. I went, woo! And I got into my bed with my snacks, and I watched Pearl Harbor. Hadn't seen it in like 10 years, and it was you.
So cool. I love those comfort films.
Oh, exactly.
Weird that it's a huge Michael Bay explosion film that's my comfort film, but hey, you know, it's also historical romance.
But that one's rooted not only in some really, you know, sound history and Americana history. There's some great people in it and doing wonderful, you know, cameo vignette drop by kind of roles from, you know, Sizemore to Baldwin, Voight, you name it. I mean, just great people keep showing up and doing really fun stuff. So there's a lot of depth to it and a lot of money spent on making it extraordinary, beautifully made.
Yes.
And Michael, in fact, he said to me the first day, because I was actually there the first day, he, on that ship, I think it was the Missouri, he said, you know, I had my first job on this ship 10 years ago. It was a Pepsi commercial. And, you know, and now he's, you know, strafing the deck with zeros and all kinds of crazy ass stuff.
Unreal.
And it was really, really beautiful and fun. And as I say, real money spent to make it extraordinary. Hmm. And, you know, the opening night, we did that one They flew us all back to Pearl Harbor.
Wow.
They got the USS Stennis, an aircraft carrier. They put a cinema screen. They parked the ship right over the graveyard of the other ship Pearl Harbor. Faith Hill came to sing the theme song that she sings for the movie. Everybody and his dog showed up. We did press on the deck of the Stennis for a week before. I mean, this was the good old days.
Wow.
It was magnificent. So I was really hoping for Pearl Harbor too, but it turns out that they, you know, they didn't need that.
They covered it all, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, that's terrific. I guess to finish this off, do you have a favorite superhero of your own, whether they've been made into a Marvel film, whether they're not Marvel, maybe they're not Marvel, but do you have a favorite superhero?
Well, you know, I was also in the Spider-Man.
Amazing
Spider-Man 2, which is one of various series of Spider-Mans for rights and other production issues that have gone from studio to studio to studio. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of a fan of that for a bit, because I liked the normal guy get zapped and become something. And that too was, you know, kind of the Iron Man feeling that something unusual happens to a normal person and they get powers. So
you and Sayer have that in common.
Yeah.
Yeah. Spider-Man's my go-to as well. Yeah.
I find that kind of, I find those kind of, those are the ones. And now, because of course I am the father of many superheroes.
Right.
My new superhero go-to is Umbrella, because I actually go around the globe collecting orphans. They're not orphans yet. I simply buy babies who, unbeknownst to themselves, have superpowers, and then I train them up. And this season, there are more of them because I had the presence of mind to go and adopt a whole bunch more. So I have the Sparrow Academy as well as the Umbrella Academy.
Oh, yeah.
And these are all people discovering their superhero potential, nurtured, of course, by the strict discipline of a stern father. So, you know, I have to say now I am my own favorite. sounds a bit like a French philosophy. Sorry.
Well, if we can't believe in ourselves, then
exactly.
What else is
I mean, it's COVID. You've got to get up in the morning and say, okay, what's good about today?
Yes.
It's different from yesterday.
I am my own superhero. I can do this.
Right.
Well, your work in Umbrella Academy is just incredible. It's such a fun show, and I'm thrilled that it keeps getting renewed, even in crazy times like this. It's fantastic to have more content like that, and to have someone like you on board who really helms the show so well in such a believable, grounded way.
Well, you're so kind. We're very lucky to work for wonderful people. Steve Blackman is our producer, showrunner, boss, and he's just assembled a magnificent group of folks that are just delightful to be around. So it's an awful lot of fun to do, as well as, you know, on the same level as the Marvel thing. It was a huge investment. So we're very mindful of what the production level is and how we really have to live up to this, and the preparation. And now the COVID protocols under which we're working are unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And yet we're making it work. It really looks like a Mars landing, and it's surreal, but we're getting it done, and we're getting it safe with masks, shields, you name it, and just keep going. But keep going at a level that I think is extraordinary and appealing to people, so that when they're stuck at home, they know, pretty soon I'll be able to flick that channel back on and those guys will be back.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Giving people art to enjoy and to comfort them in times like this.
And for us, you know, after October, November, unemployed from March, you know, I am nothing but grateful.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Well, Colm, we're so grateful that you could join us for this today. It means so much, and this has been such a fun journey for us, and to get to include you in this and have your insight is incredible.
Thanks so much for having me, guys, and good luck with the rest of it. Take care of yourselves.
You
stay
too.
Safe. Ciao.
See ya.
Thanks so much for listening. Please subscribe and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. And you can follow along for more at MCU and Me Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. Thanks so much.